Okay, so I'm here with Damien Shield, who's visiting from the US here in Australia, and I'm going to be talking to him today about how we get ourselves prepared to be simulation educators, right from the very beginning kind of what we should know about, right through to those people who are really interested in making sim a big part of their career. So Damien, I know from his work at the Center for Medical Simulation and others, and some of you, if you're Spanish speaking, might know about him because he also runs a simulation podcast. I'm going to try and say this. It's Simulación de Sura Norte. And if you want to listen to simulation in Spanish, that's your go-to. And I'll put the website on our show notes. But welcome, Damien.
Thank you. Good afternoon, I think. I'm still trying to recover from Well, it's jet lagging.
Yeah, well, just before we get into our substance here and the cases we're going to talk about, perhaps give us a little bit of a background about your work in SIM and a little bit about you.
Yeah, my pleasure. So I'm originally from Argentina, so I'm used to being on this side of the world. And I grew up in Buenos Aires until I was 14. Then I moved to the States, where I completed all my training through medical school, emergency medicine training, and then a simulation fellowship. I was the first fellow at Stratus, the Center for Medical Simulation at Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is located in Boston. And at the time, I also took instructor training courses at the Center for Medical Simulation and then joined the faculty on a part-time basis while I was the medical director at the New York Simulation Center for the Health Sciences in New York City. And I would spend about 10 or 15% of my time teaching around the world with CMS in both English and Spanish. And over the last few months, I've relocated to Boston, where I now serve as the senior director for the Institute for Medical Simulation, which is the faculty development arm of the Center for Medical Simulation. And I'm also an assistant professor in emergency medicine at Harvard Medical School. I do my clinical work at Brigham Women's about a day a week or so.
Mm-hmm. And I can vouch for that, having spent a little bit of a Sunday shift with you only a few months ago back at the Brigham, a bit like coming home to Stratus, I guess. So, Damien, I thought we might pose a couple of different case studies here to help us talk through this idea about training, courses, and fellowship in SIM. So imagine we've got an emergency department nurse, a fellow who's been given a little bit of time to, and I quote, do some sim from their nurse educator. This guy hasn't had much educational experience, but he's really keen and he is kind of into tech things. In fact, that was the reason why he was chosen. He's got a couple of the doctors who are also interested in doing sim, and a couple of them have done some debriefing courses. But for the most part, he's kind of going from a standing start. He's got a sim man or something equivalent, and he wants to know, where do I start? What kind of things do I need to know? Are they educational? Are they technical? Is it debriefing? How should I get myself prepared?
Yeah, so this is a very common scenario. And I find there's a dusty mannequin in a closet. It had been funded through some grant or charity, and now that it's finally time to do something. My view, of course, is that it's not about the stuff, it's about the people. So I would start with that. For this person or this team, I think they should be excellent, well-respected clinicians. The fundamental basis is the kind of care we provide to our patients. That is at the heart of teaching with simulation. Beyond that, though, it's not exactly like teaching at the bedside. There are certainly differences that are worth recognizing. And so getting a start is important. The very first place I would advise this person to do, the very first thing I'd advise them to do, the first place to look is within their own institution, because most likely they are not the only person. They might feel that way, but there's likely other like-minded people across their hospital. So just getting the mannequin out or starting to talk up people in all kinds of areas, including the resuscitation committee, or if you might call it something else, let me know. Quality and safety boards, different arms of education. There's probably somebody doing something that they may not be calling simulation, but they're probably doing it. And so really anybody doing experiential learning, they're going to be on your side.
Yeah, and I would agree with that from the Australian context, and the kind of people I would be looking for that would include the ones you mentioned, including the resuscitation people, whoever runs ALS programs in the institution, but also the local university. Sometimes they've got SIM programs running and they're just not actually talking to the people at the hospital, and that can be a great source of expertise.
Yeah. If you wanted to then think about going out some layers, neighboring universities, there's growth in local and regional groups. Across the U.S., we've had very successful regional organizations in different states or even in different city communities that have gotten together to support each other. People in simulation are so generous, so friendly, will be happy to share, come show you, come teach a course, come to my course, I'll show you mine, you'll show me yours. It's just the way we've all gotten started. I would then also look at regional conferences, because you really can't talk that much about simulation. This is one of the things we found with the podcast and other. You just have to experience it. So you might be given the mannequin and they told you go do sim, but until you really experience it, you just don't know what the power of it could be. So a regional meeting would be a very interesting thing. And then and you might consider a national meeting. So I've had the pleasure of, for example, speaking at the NZASH conference in Christchurch a couple of years ago. I know SimHealth is a great conference here. There's an international INACSL, which is the International Clinical, I can't even say.
It's for this mainly a nursing conference? Is that the one you're talking about? Yeah.
I want to say it right. If you're dealing in standardized patients, the Association for Standardized Patient Educators would be a great conference. And the Society for Simulation and Healthcare, for which I currently sit on the board, has an annual meeting called the International Meeting on Simulation and Healthcare, which is alternates between the East Coast and the West Coast of the U.S.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So those conferences are great, I think, early on. I wouldn't wait too long to go, because it'll show you the real breadth of what simulation is and who the people are. The networking is amazing. And I think simulation is really hard, so you should be really passionate about the slice of it that you pick. And so to me, seeing the full menu early on would be quite helpful.
Mm-hmm. So just to...
There too, you'll find some pre-conferences where you might do a 2-3-4-hour workshop to give you some early skills that you can then bring home mm-hmm. to experiment.
Yeah, and probably get to know some people in those workshops as well as the content. All right, so just to recap on some of the things you've been saying there, Damien, you've said get yourself involved locally at your institution and just outside. Look for those conferences. Look for others who are doing similar things and go and see it and be part of it and do it. What about things like online courses? Because one of the things I know from the Australian perspective is I would recommend this person did something like the NetSim program, and our listeners would remember Margaret Bierman. I did a little interview with her about that. Great online modules and some face-to-face workshops. Are there other sort of online or other resources you think people can do in their own?
It's not been the main part of my experience, but I'm a big fan of YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a ton of resources available there. There is there's an organization called SimGhost that provides a lot of ideas in terms of making your own models and really on the technical side, and a very good website called Healthy Simulation. I think those are really great early steps, kind of what to do, and I would highly recommend that.
And our listeners will again remember we interviewed Lance Bailey when I was in Singapore last November, but we'll put those websites back up on the blog post, because I agree, I think they're a great resource.
In terms of understanding what's debriefing, a bunch of us are working on a project led by Brent Toma, Adam Chang, Walter Epic, Jenny Rudolph, and others, and that's called Debrief to Learn. And I think that's a very nice repository of all things debriefing. If you just want to get exposed to what is it, how does it work, it would be an introduction. And I think a good precursor to then going to one of the face-to-face courses, a, a 3 or 4 day, 5 day in-person course that will really transform your practice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One of my mentors, Robert Simon, says, you only get one chance to make a first impression. And so this is really something to consider, kind of when to launch your program. Some people would advise early small wins. Don't bite too much. Do something that people are happy. Get some data. Other people would say get some expert advice and then launch with a real strong start. I don't know, Vic, what you think in terms of early starts of a program.
Yeah, I am a little bit torn by that. I generally like to start things by setting a date that gives everybody a sense of urgency, because I also think that perhaps the slight counterpoint to that, although I too take Robert's wisdom on board, is that perfect can be the enemy of good. And you can spend a long time trying to get yourself ready to deliver your perfect sim, only to discover that 12 months later you haven't started. So I think you're right. There are some things that you really do need to make sure you've got enough technical expertise, you haven't aimed too high, you've got maybe some more friendly participants when you start, you're not getting too ambitious about the scope. But I'm definitely for making it good, but also cracking on and doing it. So just to recap on some of those things. So again, we're talking here about someone newish to the simulation world. And I think we've covered, if I might call them the domains of practice, some of these things are about running a program of sim, and that's got a bit of change management in it. Some of the core skills, I think we've touched on technical ones related to healthy simulation and moulage. We've talked about debriefing. I think we've talked a little bit about sharing, which might help with stuff like scenario writing. And then, as you said, those workshops. So I think we've kind of got our beginner on the road. Other things?
Yeah, I think if I might just say one of my pet peeves, I think scenario writing is really not necessary. I would really think about adopting and adapting. So the medical education portal from the AAMC is, I think, a really good area. Our journal, Simulation in Healthcare, used to publish cases. So there's plenty of them out there that could be adapted, and I would just think about fitting them to your purpose.
And I'll give a shout out here to EM Sim Cases, another brilliant FOMED resource in simulation. So that's another great place, and they're always well researched and well put together.
Now, what we've been talking about so far is this kind of grassroots, slowly starting and jumping into simulation, which is really, I would say, the majority of our colleagues' experience. Everyone has really, who is now really the four parents of the field, have started this way. And then I think there's a new wave coming. And so I'm personally one of the people in that new wave that has formal training. So I did a fellowship, I did a master's in education. I did it at the start of my career, which represented, I think, a real springboard towards a leadership position in simulation. And I think that's going to be more and more the norm. Certainly in the US, we have some new trends in healthcare education where simulation-based training is really going to be more the norm rather than exception. But the regulatory bodies will require training. So certificate programs, master's programs, fellowships, even PhD programs in simulation have been emerging. We have a project at the Society for Simulation in Healthcare to gather all those formal training programs and catalog them. So we should have a forthcoming publicly available catalog on the SSH website. And we also have an interest group that's gotten together. It's called an affinity group. And we're working on a few things, including what is the common core curriculum? What are the things that we're all doing? Not to standardize, but to support each other and say, these are the main elements required in formal training and simulation. We're working on an exchange program so that people can taste the diversity, because if you visited one simulation program, you've visited one simulation program. And we also are working on leadership and educational development content for the annual meeting so that people who are in charge of leading those programs can keep on developing. The final piece, which I'm really excited, is actually developing a fellows community of practice, because they're usually in ones and twos out there amongst the different centers with people like us training for a year or two, and it can be rather lonely and disconnected. So we're working towards developing that community of practice. there through the society, and we also have a small project at the at CMS that's related to that.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And as someone who's had a simulation fellow, I recognise all these same challenges, and have also happily pinched the reading lists from NYSim and a range of others through that sharing process with some of the other simulation fellows. So this is a nice segue into maybe another version of this challenge. And so the case study that I suggested here is, let's imagine we've got a what we would call an aesthetic registrar, you might call it an anesthesiology resident, someone who's maybe done the bulk of their clinical training, getting towards the end of that, but now quite determined that sim in particular is going to be a big part of their career. Maybe they see their trajectory as being the director of a simulation program, or in some way, shape or form, this is a big bit. So obviously they've been through the process we've just talked about at the more beginner level, and maybe they've embarked in some of these courses and fellowships. But what kind of advice do you give that person?
So I would start by telling them they're wrong. So it's not a career in simulation, it's a career in education. You're probably going to be very involved in education and or research and or patient safety. Simulation is going to be the tool, the vehicle, how you're going to accomplish your bigger goals. I think our field is misnamed, if you will. And although we do, on a day-to-day basis, see ourselves as simulationistas, we're really educators that happen to primarily use simulation as our teaching tool. That opening of the aperture is what happened for me when I came out of fellowship. I had a goal to be a medical director of a big sim center and getting it started and making it happen and successful. And along with my colleague, Grace Eng, who's the nursing director, I think we accomplished that over 6 years. And I thought I was on a path towards then becoming some kind of small dean at the university. And of course, it's a good path to be on, but it's an education path.
Mm-hmm.
As I went along this, I found that faculty development was my real passion, helping people reach their potential as educators. And so I would be very excited to talk to this person. What I would tell them is a few things. One is, they should definitely get formal training in education, a master's in education or a master's in simulation. Recently, they're mostly master's in science with a focus in clinical education or simulation education or health professions education. There's various of those that are online, in person, or some kind of hybrid. For me, I was lucky that my master's was part of my fellowship. So if you can get your institution to fund it, even better.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I think it's an excellent investment of both time and money. Working and cutting your teeth, if you will, doing a lot of simulation, spending a year or two where that's primarily your focus, I think it's really, really key. In anesthetics, this might be a more straightforward path because unlike them, for us in emergency medicine, we are just always thinking about doing everything. So I think that's been a real key to my success, is to be able to say, I love emergency medicine. It's a thing I do one day a week. They spend the bulk of my 100-hour week, 92 other hours of my life, thinking, breathing, working in, connecting about simulation, and that's my real focus. And I would tell anybody who's thinking about embarking in a career in education or in simulation that they should spend some 10,000 hours, if you want to invoke the deliberate practice, get their 10,000 hours in the domain. They're already trained in anesthesia. It's time to train in simulation.
Mm, I think it's like anything. We wouldn't imagine we could start doing some other skill set just like we were interns once upon a time in our clinical work. We are the same, really, when we embark on these higher educational leadership type roles. We have to realize the skills we have to gain, and we should have just as much respect for them as we had for those clinical skills. Well, it sounds like you've got some good advice for those people. And for them, networking, you've talked about them connecting through things like SSH and the affinity groups that you've got. So it sounds like a bright future for this person. Any other advice?
Yeah, as you mentioned, networking, I think being going to the meetings, being on the listserv, that's the kind of lowest peripheral participation that is available, and that's good. But I would rapidly encourage anyone who's really focusing on a career in education to get involved with a society, whatever the one you that you want to kind of invest in, and pick one. So initially, I was really involved in the Simulation Academy at the Society for Academic Emergency, and I went to IMSH. I then started to really focus on a particular committee within SSH where I was a member, and then I became the vice chair and the chair and eventually got on the board. And so I would recommend, like in simulation, doing something, not just reading about it, hearing about it, but getting involved in a committee. And that's the best form of networking and leadership experience. I found that you could really try out a lot of your leadership skills further ahead within your volunteer space, your service space, than you would in your institution. So as a young person in simulation, you attend a lot of meetings. As a young person volunteering your time in a society, you're running meetings. And so that's developmentally a really wonderful opportunity that's in the domain. So I would recommend that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think what you highlight there, though, and what I'd say from our experience is sometimes there's a little tension between joining the sim crew and leaving your clinical crew. And I certainly know that, say, in emergency medicine in Australia, we do have quite a few educational fellowships and simulation fellowships. But to some extent, I feel like gathering them together, unfortunately, we lose a bit because we don't spend as much time with the folks involved in simulation who come from a nursing background or who come from other specialties. And for me, one of the great things about SIM is that I go to these conferences, and honestly, many of the people I know in SIM, I don't actually know what their clinical thing is, whether they're a doctor or a nurse. And in fact, someone you just mentioned earlier in the podcast, I thought, gee, I didn't know she was a nurse. So it just goes to show, I think it's got a great opportunity to connect different healthcare tribes through the common modality. And the other thing that I would add is, because you've talked very much from an education focus, and I've recently been spending a bit more time with the quality improvement people. And I think just as you said, well, maybe think about yourself as an educator. I think for some people, depending on what you're doing with your simulation, start to think about yourself as a quality improvement person as well, because that's another whole skill set.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I think quality improvement and research. I think many of our colleagues are primarily researchers. Well, they don't have to be brilliant educators. They're asking the questions that move the field forward. Others, they're more on education. At the direct level, they have a passion for interprofessional education or a particular training in a field. I recently talked to someone whose passion is around regional anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the complex education of those procedures is going to be the thing of their scholarship. Are they an clinical researcher or are they an education researcher within SIM? Depends on where they take it. So I totally agree. And I think also don't be afraid to hop from one to the other. So I can't tell this to people enough. You cannot plan your career. You can plan your next 3 to 3 years or so, meaning you can only plan your current job. And
yep,
that's the thing you're going to do. And then something else is going to evolve out of that role or the next role. And the career is built on based on projects and experiences.
Excellent. Well, Damien, I feel like we've had lessons in simulation education and lessons in life. It's been a pleasure.